498 Bill 6.
Major Horridge, Reel 6. Could you continue your story of the submarine?
Yes, well, I think I got to the point when I was talking to an officer who actually was Captain Hartley in his cabin when the whistle started to blow. It's 6 blasts. And my officer said, oh, curse it, we've got to go on another of these boat parades. And lo and behold, the 7th one blew. So, of course, we shot out of the cabin as soon as we could, because that was a genuine thing. And it turns out that the captain of the ship saw a torpedo coming, knocked the man at the wheel over, turned the wheel as fast as he could, and the ship answered its helm very well, and the torpedo went between the rudder and the log line and dismissed us by a few yards, I suppose. So it weren't actually a torpedo, but it was a very near thing.
Where did you arrive in France?
At Marseille.
And what happened then?
Well, then we took train to a place called Pont-Remy, which was on the main line from Calais to Paris. And that took 3 days. And of course, we got out of the train at various stations for our meals, but we, of course, we slept in the train, having to sit up, no bunks or beds or anything like that, of course, and arrived at Pont-Remy, and I was billeted on the mayor of a little village called Liacourt, as were the other officers of the company. And this was about the end of February, or middle of February, 1917, and it was winter. And it was an extremely cold winter, and there was no heat in this. We were billeted in an outhouse, and there was no heat in it. And of course, I think probably the farmer, the mayor, who was a farmer, I suppose, hadn't got anything to eat with. So we just had to put up with this very cold weather. And when we were not outside doing something, training or something of that sort, the warmest place was to get into bed, fully dressed, of course. Naturally, not in the daytime, but that was the warmest place.
How did the French treat you?
Oh, the French were all right, quite pleasant, yeah. Never all the time I was in France came across any unpleasantness with the French.
Was there any sort of special training for Western Front conditions?
Not that I can remember now, no, I don't think there was, no. We're all supposed to be fairly well-trained soldiers at this time.
You were sent to another battalion to experience frontline conditions. Could you describe
yes,
that?
Yes, before ever the division was sent up into the line itself, in order to get experience, officers were sent up to people who actually were in the line. And I and Captain Hartley were sent up to the 1st Division. And it was quite an interesting experience, because they were in a trench opposite a place called Villers Carbonell, where I believe now it's on one of the main roads, north and south in France, and I believe there's a restaurant and a big sort of stopping place at Villers Carbonell. So I've been told. I haven't been there. Well, that's where we were in the line. And we had to, of course, go up into the line at night. And we arrived at brigade headquarters. And we were given guides. And it seemed to me to be very queer, because when there was always this noise of firing and things in Gallipoli, it seemed to be very quiet. Anyhow, we got to the front line, and lo and behold, there wasn't anybody there. Battalion weren't there. And it so happened that very night, it was the night that the Germans retired from the Somme battlefield back to the Hindenburg line, a matter of 40 miles, and when we were at brigade headquarters, they didn't know this had happened, and when we got to the front line, So the battalion was out looking for them. The next morning, we could stroll about no man's land, and there was no Germans in the vicinity. So, of course, we didn't get many experience, but it was very interesting to be there just at that particular moment.
Could you do... This gave you an opportunity to walk around in no man's land, where previously
yes,
you couldn't.
Yes.
What could you? What did it look like, the battlefield area?
Well, there was much... what I can remember of it, there was far more distance between that line and the German line than what there'd been on Gallipoli. They weren't as close to each other.
Was the ground well shelled, or...?
No, I don't think particularly, not there, no. I don't think there'd ever been any big battle over that particular bit of ground.
Did you have barbed wire in front of the trenches?
I suppose it must have had, yes. But, God, when we realised there was nobody in front of us, we didn't do much notice, I suppose, of that.
Did you move forward with this other... Can you remember what this battalion was?
No, I can't remember for certain, but I think it was the Welsh Fusiliers. The adjutant was a man I'd been at school with, who I knew quite well, called Dunn. And that was rather strange, but you're asking me something for a long time ago, and I really can't remember for certain what the name of... But I think it was the Welsh Fusiliers.
Did they move forward?
Yes, we soon discovered that the Germans had gone. Captain Hartley and myself went back again. No point in stopping there. We weren't gaining any experience or anything, so we went back again to the battalion.
So you went back to Learcourt, did you?
No, we weren't at Learcourt that particular time. We'd moved to somewhere on the Somme, the name of which base I can't just remember.
I believe your brother was in the Royal Flying Corps and you were given an aeroplane flight.
Yeah, my younger brother was in the Flying Corps, and at one period we were not so very far away from each other, so I went to see him. And he had been then in France some considerable time, and he asked me if I'd like to have a flight in his aeroplane, which was called a B-2C. And it was a two-seater, no cover, of course, over the heads, just a two-seater and a single engine. And so I said, yes, all right. And so we went up, and it's my first flight I'd ever made. So it was a bit strange to me, because whenever the plane turned round, you see, you were looking down at the ground, nothing sort of between you and the ground, no sides to the thing much to hang on to. And then, in the end, I couldn't speak to him because he was in front of me, and the noise of the engine made it impossible to speak. And I discovered that the nose of the engine seemed to be going up in the air, and the engine seemed to stop, and we seemed to go straight down to the earth. And I thought to myself, well, is he doing this on purpose, or can't he help it? And I didn't know. Anyhow, he came out of this glide down, whatever the proper term is, I don't know, and all was well. He was doing it on purpose, I suppose, to give me a bit of a fright, possibly. I remember, though, when I got to the ground, my nose was bleeding, and I thought to myself, well, infantry had the worst job, but I began to wonder whether the flying people didn't have just as bad a job, because if you're an infantryman, you can generally get behind something if necessary, but you can't get behind anything up in the air like that.
You were sent also to the Third Army Training School.
Yes,
the
Plexi Corps.
Could you describe what sort of training you received there?
Well, we went into platoons. We were allotted different platoons, you see, and we learnt all sorts of different kinds of training. I can't remember exactly what we did, but manoeuvres and rifle training and all that sort of thing, the usual sort of thing that you had to learn.
By now, were officers carrying rifles, or were they still sticking to revolvers?
That is a question I can't really answer. I don't really know. I think they still had revolvers.
When did you return to your battalion?
Well, I returned to the battalion just after the division had been sent up into the front line. The division was sent up into the front line at a part of the line which was well on the east side. The end of the British line was at St. Quentin, and we were just to the west of St. Quentin, a place called Epey. And we were in the line there, which is a quiet sector. And then we were, after that, in the line at a place called Romsfar, which was near Epey. And then we went into part of the line called Villers-Plewish. And there was a railway run through Villers-Plewish. And of course, you see, we were advancing, following up the Germans, and we were withdrawing this 40 miles to the Hindenburg line. We weren't in these places very long, but the Germans moved further back, we moved further up. And Villers-Plewish, the railway ran through the line, and we were in a ravine. And I remember that I was sent away one day to go to a court-martial, to be present as an officer. I wasn't being court-martialed myself. And when I got back to the battalion, I was told, well, we were being relieved next morning, so you don't need to go back to the to your company. Stop at battalion headquarters. And that night there was a raid. There was a raid on the company on our right, and one or two of our fellows got wounded during this raid business in the ravine with the shrapnel and things coming over. And then we moved out of there, and then we went to corner of Haverincourt Wood. Now, this is a bit more interesting, because we were in front of a village called Tresco, and for Tresco, there was a reserve trench near the village. Then there was a sap going towards Femmy Wood, which was really part of Haverincourt Wood, and that was about 200 yards long. And then the end of that sap in front of Femmy Wood, there was trenches were being built. My company were put into support at the back, and the other three companies were digging their trenches and entrenching in front of Femmy Wood. And our duty as the company in reserve was to send a body of people out every night to lie in front of the trenches that were being dug and being wired, so as to prevent any surprise attack by the enemy. That was our job as in the support company. And then it was discovered that somewhere in this Femmy Wood, which was, as you say, 150 yards in front of our front line, there was a German sentry post there at night. And it was decided that a patrol should be sent out, a fighting patrol should be sent out with the instructions to do in the people in the sentry post and wait for the relief of the sentry post, which would take place later on in the evening, and do them in as well. And then they were allowed to come back, and a special time had to be mentioned, because in the dark, if the people in the front line didn't know exactly when you were coming in, they might have thought you were the enemy and shot at you. So you had to have it come back at a specific time. So an officer in our company called Lord was detailed to go on this fighting patrol. And the company commander at the time was a Captain Peacock, and I was sort of second in command of the company. And when the time came, about 7 o'clock in the evening for this patrol to go out, Peacock said to me, "So go and see Lord, and here's a half a bottle of whiskey, go and give him a drink before he goes." So I went, and we were in a trench at the back of a good 300 yards probably from Femmy Wood. And we were sitting at opposite each other in the trench, and Lord was having a drink of this whiskey when he suddenly gave a shout, fell in the bottom of the trench, and a bullet had come in and hit him in the ribs. And I looked behind us, and I saw one of our chaps walking about in the open, which he shouldn't have been, and he was a bit of a half-wit anyhow, and of course they'd been firing at him, and they'd hit Lord. So I had to go back then to Captain Peacock and tell him that Lord had ordered combat, he'd be taken off to hospital. So he said, "Well, I don't know what we're going to do. I can't send Woolley because he's only just arrived at the company. I don't quite know what I better do." I said, "You don't need to tell me, I know where to go. That's me." So I went with the patrol. And we consisted of a Lewis gun, two people on the Lewis gun, and eight picked soldiers, not all privates, sergeant, few corporal, a lance corporal, a pit man. And so we went to the head of this sap, and I sent out two men to go in front of us as a sort of advance guard, who got to Fenby Wood without anything happening, and then we all crawled out, and we got to the corner of Fenby Wood, which by incident I had been to on two occasions since the war when I visited the battlefield, and I set up the Lewis gun, and had a look, and there in the wood was a sort of wooden hut, and the Germans were inside this hut. Now, you couldn't see far into the wood. It was pretty dense. I didn't know where the other part of the German line was, whether it was in the wood or where it was, because I hadn't been there before. And I think that, theoretically, I should have sent people to try to capture these fellas in the hut. But I was a bit scared that there were Germans who would see us, and they would be killed on the way trying to get these people out of the hut, so I didn't do it. And eventually, the time came when the people in the hut came out to put their equipment on and assume their duties as the sentries, as the outlying sentries. And this they did. And the Lewis gun let fly at them, and the other fellows did, and I could have, if I'd wanted to do, I could have said, "Don't fire till I fired," and then I could have said, "Oh, well, I'd killed one of the enemy," but I didn't particularly want to be in that position, so I didn't fire at all. And some of them were killed, some of them, I think, got away wounded, and then we had to wait. It was getting dark, of course, by this time. We had to wait at least another 2 hours before we went could go back, because the orders were not to go back till 12 o'clock. And it got darker and darker until eventually you could hardly see anything in the wood at all, it was so thick. I had the eight men who were not on the Lewis gun, four of them down one side of the wood, and at right angles the other four down the other side of the wood, and the Lewis gun was on the corner. And it got a bit dark. And one of these soldiers, whose name shall not be mentioned, came to me and said, "I can't stand this waiting, so can I go back?" And he was one of the ones I sent out in the first place as the advance guard to get this trench. He'd been commended for bravery in the field on a previous occasion, and I think had got some stripes through it. And so I realised he might put the wind up the other chaps. So I sent him back. I just goes to show that Some people can be brave under certain circumstances and yet can't be brave under other certain circumstances. At any rate, eventually, somebody came from down one side of the wood and said, they're coming down the side of the wood, sir. I said, how many do you think there are? Well, I said, I don't know, about 40, I think. Then one of the other chaps from the other side of the wood, on the other side, came and said, they're coming down the side of the wood, sir. I said, how many do you think there are? They said, well, I don't know, about 40, I think. So the sergeant got hold of the Lewis gun, fired it down both sides of the wood, and then I gave the order to withdraw, because I didn't think that seven or eight of us could be expected to fight 80 Germans. I don't think that was in the orders to do so. So I withdrew the force, and unfortunately, one of my soldiers, I must have had a bomb in his hand when the Germans were coming down the side of the trench, possibly pulled the pin out, and got the order to retreat, and the Germans had opened fire. He'd gone down on the ground to avoid being shot, dropped the bomb and had killed him. He'd gone off and killed him. Unfortunately, that was very unfortunate. That was the one casualty we had. So that was my experience on the trenches in front of Tresco near Femmy Wood, which is still called Femmy Wood.
When you when you went out for this raid, had you taken any special precautions, such as blacking your faces or anything?
Oh, no, nothing like that. We didn't dress ourselves up like they do today. We just went out like our own selves.
When you were in the quieter areas that you mentioned earlier, such as Effie,
Epey
and Villers Plowish, what sort of daily routine did you do in the trenches there?
Well, nothing except to guard the trenches, that was all. There was really nothing I don't think could mention about it. You weren't allowed, of course, to take any clothing off or anything like that, but you were on duty as sentries from so long and that sort of thing. There was nothing else to do.
Did you have proper underground dugouts in these areas? Or?
Yes, there were dugouts at Epey, yes. There were no dugouts. The one I just mentioned at Villers Plewish, I don't think they dug out there. There may have been holes made in the back of the trench, something like that, but no deep dugout, because on the move, you see, following up the Germans. It wasn't like the Somme battlefield where they'd been there for 2 years before Somme battle started, and they dug all the trenches. We were on the move, we weren't staying at any of these bases long. Actually, it might be of interest to tell you that from this place in front of Tresco, there was a sort of garden on a bit higher ground, and I went there and I could actually see the Hindenburg Line. And it seemed to me that the Hindenburg Line was guarded by barbed wire, which looked to be almost 100 yards across. If so, of course, whatever artillery you like to turn on it couldn't possibly have damaged it, because it was merely blown it up and it had fallen down the same place. So, of course, it was the Hindenburg Line was never taken until tanks came along to do it.
Did you know anything about the existence of tanks by this time?
No, I didn't know anything about them. But towards the end of my time in France, we knew we had tanks, because at the Battle of Passchendaele, I saw tanks, I know we knew about that, but we haven't come to that in the story. But towards the end, we put field guns in the front line in case the Germans had tanks. That's all more I remember about the German tanks. I never saw a German tank. I don't think there were any.
During this same period, when you weren't in the line, what sort of duties were you doing?
We didn't have any particular duties unless there was a fatigue party to do. We were resting, you see. We realised that we hadn't had very much sleep. as I've told you, in Gallipoli we had to stand to, we had to be on duty at night. As a matter of fact, in France, you couldn't allow to sleep at all at night. In Gallipoli, you could sleep, provided you weren't on duty, and you weren't a sentry, or if you were an officer, you weren't doing your 2 hours duty, you were allowed to go to sleep. You weren't allowed to go to sleep in France. You had to be awake every night, all night. And of course, this got very tiring. Now, I think I should also add that in this, when we were at this place in front of Tresco, where I've just described the fighting patrol, there was another occasion when I had to go up the main sap, which I've just already said was about 200 yards to the front line, to visit the parts of my company who were lying out in front of the barbed wire while the other companies were digging the trench and wiring. I went up with my runner, and at the top of this sap, there were two stretcher bearers. And so my runner was a corporal, Corporal Lee his name was. He sat down with the stretcher bearers, had a chat with them, and I thought to myself, well, it's getting time now for these chaps to be coming in or lying out in front of the trenches. So I walked round a traverse, and suddenly there was a big crash behind me. It was dark, of course, late at night, or early morning, really. Crash behind me, and something obviously dropped. And I walked back round the traverse, and I stepped on these three chaps, and a mini had fallen right on top of them, killed all three. They're buried in Royal Corps Cemetery.
This Minnenwerfer threat, this was something new to you, I presume.
We didn't have it in Gallipoli, but it wasn't all that new in France. It was quite regular in France.
Could you describe what the Minnenwerfers were and what...
Yes, well,
you
could see it at night. You could see sparks coming. It was like something floating through the air with sparks coming out of the back. And you, if you saw it, of course, you had to watch the direction. And if you thought it was coming in your direction, you got to get into some safe place quick as you could. But, of course, on the average, of course, it wasn't coming in your direction. It was going somewhere else. But as long as you were not in the same traverse when the thing dropped, you were fairly safe because, of course, you were protected by the trenches.
Did the British have anything similar to hurl back?
Oh, yes, they had, yes. Oh, yes, they were known as Ishmaelites, the people who looked after our Minnenwerfers, or that's the German name, of course, but our trench mortars. They were Ishmaelites, which means every man's hand is against them, because they used to come down the trench and then stop and fire off several of their bombs, move on again, and then the Germans used to retaliate with shelling.